It is time now to begin the reading of today's Boston Herald on the Talking Information Center. It is Wednesday, the 19th of August, 2026. With the Boston Herald, we say hello to Ed and Fred.
Thank you, John, and good morning, all. Mass General Brigham nurses blast CEO's $800,000 raise. Pay boost pegged at 9% comes amid contract standoff. By Grace Zokovich, union nurses at Mass General Brigham spoke out against news of the Mass General Brigham CEO's 9% raise to nearly $9.2 million in compensation in fiscal 2025 as contentious contract negotiations continue for Brigham and Women's Hospital nurses and MGB home care clinicians. The fact that MGB's CEO received an $800,000 pay hike to almost $9.2 million makes it impossible for MGB to credibly argue that it can't settle a fair contract, said Brigham MNA Bargaining Committee Chair Kelly Morgan. This is about choices. MGB is choosing enormous executive compensation while refusing to negotiate with the nurses and clinicians who provide the very patient care that makes MGB successful. The hospital system CEO, Ann Klebanski, received $9,180,758 compensation for October 2024 to September 2025, according to the most recent MGB's IRS Form 990 filings, up from $8.4 million in fiscal year 2024. The about 4,000 Brigham and Women's Hospital nurses and 465 MGB home care clinicians went on strike in July after months of stalled negotiations, making history as the largest Massachusetts nurse strike and marking an escalation in tensions with the hospital. The MNA noted the increase is equivalent to $4,413 per hour for someone working 40 hours per week. And Kablansky is the highest-paid hospital system CEO in Massachusetts. According to pay reports shared by Brigham and Women's Hospital executives, the hospital's top 100 paid nurses earn between around $412,000 to $237,000 in the last year. MGB did not immediately respond to a request for comment Tuesday. The MNA said Tuesday that the hospital system has repeatedly refused to meaningfully negotiate with either bargaining unit since the strike. On August 11th, MGB informed the Brigham MNA Bargaining Committee that MGB believes negotiations have reached a practical impasse and does not want to continue meeting under the current circumstances unless nurses make significant changes to their proposal, the MNA said, noting the administration similarly refused to move during negotiations with home care clinicians on August 13th. The BWH nurses are seeking terms, including a meaningful cost of living wage increase, limits on MGB's reliance on temporary nurses to support continuity and quality of care, and affordable health insurance with meaningful plan choice, the union said. The union noted the home care clinicians are similarly looking for competitive wages to help recruit and retain experienced clinicians, reasonable caseloads, and clear and transparent productivity standards. The MNA said the hospital's offer to BWH nurses of two potential paths, accept no cost of living wage increase, and potentially discuss other issues or drop other outstanding issues, and potentially discuss wages, has led negotiations to stall again. This is corporate greed in its clearest form, said MGB Home Care MNA Bargaining Committee Chair Shannon Vieira. MGB found $9.2 million in a single year for its CEO, but when clinicians ask for competitive wages, safe patient caseloads and working conditions that allow us to safely provide complex care for patients in their homes, suddenly MGB claims it cannot meet our needs.
From the opinion page, Minogue needs to take the nuclear option. In 1978, Governor Mike Dukakis was kind of more feminized. He was kind of a more feminized beta male version of Maura Healey. Smug, supercilious, abysmally unsuccessful, often wrong, but never in doubt. He was, of course, heavily favored to win the reelection. But on primary night, the Duke was crushed by a pro-life, pro-death penalty tax-cutting ex-NFL lineman named Ed King. On the Democrat primary, everyone was shocked. One of Ed King's top operatives was an ex-state rep from High Park named Angelo Berlandi, whose conversation made Mike Proctor and Sean Good seem like choir boys. At Anthony's Pier 4 election night, a reporter asked Angelo how the street guys from Boston had crushed the imperious Harvard snot from Brookline. We put all the hate groups together in one spot, Berlandi said, and we let it boil. Exactly. Last week on the Cape, I told the story of Mike Minogue, the Republican frontrunner for governor. I like Mike Minogue, but his campaign not so much. I think he needs fewer Beltway consultants and more Angela Berlandis. I understand that Massachusetts is totally different now than it was in 1978. Most of Ed King's voters are dead or have fled. It may be impossible for a conservative to win under any circumstances now. But damn, Minogue has unlimited money. He's squandering it on feel-good TV spots and a campaign against the worst governor in state history, even more terrible than Charlie Baker. Here's my free, unsolicited advice for Mike Minogue. No more Mr. Nice Guy. Fire up the Angelo Berlandi's kettle. You don't have to use the phrase hate groups, but think about all the shall we say, afflicted groups that you could micro-target with millions of dollars worth of social media. Behind them, remind them of how the Democrats have screwed them up for the past 4 years. And forget how broadcast TV, unless it's football, nobody's watching and except the nursing homes. All the money in the Channel 5, it's like bombing the rubble. Here's who you should be going after. Call them whatever you want. How about those $2.3 million voters who in 2024 voted for a legislative audit and the hacks totally refused to allow it? That's 72% of the electorate. Are you in a hate group group if you think that the state should be cooperating with the feds in getting illegal alien criminals off the street instead of trying to protect Maura's beloved residents? Does your blood pressure rise a little every time you see a court docket involving a heinous violent criminal and it includes a notation interpreter present? Do you like or dislike the parole board letting out scores of bloodthirsty convicted killers because they're emerging adults? Where were you appalled not only by the pro-abortion bill that Healey signed into law last week, but by the coven of shrews behind her clapping and cheering at the thought of legalized infanticide? When you pick your utility bill and you see And you see nine separate surcharges, including ones for both transit and transmission. You are part of a hate group if you wonder if you're not being scammed. Do you think the ICE agents should be allowed to park in the downtown Boston? It is only MAGA people who wonder why a $2 billion courthouse contract in Springfield goes to a group of fat cat Democrat insiders, including Rep. Arianna Presley's jailbird husband, who did 10 years in prison as a drug dealer and now claims to be an empowered consultant. Where were you, fired or canceled for not getting the COVID jab, for not following the science that turned out to be a total scam? Did you work to get signatures on either the rent control or the income tax cut referendum questions, only to see both of them tossed by the Supreme Judicial Court because they would have inconvenienced the entrenched hackerama? How are those bike lanes working out for you? Do you ever wonder about the propriety of Governor Healey's nominating her wrinkly old sapphic soulmate, whom she dumped for a 25-year younger heartthrob who once worked under her in the AG's office for $227,000 a year, a sinecure on the SJC? It's not exactly an alimony, but do you enjoy having to drive up to New Hampshire to buy menthol cigarettes but not marijuana? Are you happy about the billions of dollars in welfare fraud, like $7 million stolen by Haitians out of a 150-square-foot storefront Mattapan store? How about the two Stoneham cops stealing $40 million in mass saves funds, and not a single cop in Massachusetts could be bothered to investigate the heist? Are you a member of a hate group if you wonder whether the state needs either a heat resilience coordination or an undersecretary of decarbonization? Have you ever asked yourself why the state needs a Muslim commissioner but not a Methodist commissioner or Jehovah's Witnesses commissioner? And if you've ever considered whether genital mutilation of children is good public policy, why, you may be a member of a hate group, at least as far as Maura Healey's concerned. If you mean spiritual enough, if you're mean-spirited enough to believe that felonious state cops should lose their pensions after being convicted of COVID welfare fraud, you may well be ready for the pot, the kettle pot, not the THC. How about everybody who lives in those MBTA communities where the state wants you to build so-called low-income housing for illegal aliens with no income? You are a hater if you object to having your nice, powerful life, peaceful life, wrecked by gangbangers. Are the police, are the public schools in your community getting better or worse? Do you sometimes wonder why, when the state has $70 billion budget, local aid to your town is being cut? Yet more and more billions go to the gateway communities, are illegal aliens. Have you ever asked yourself, is Maura Healey really a Catholic? Can you imagine what Angela Berlandi would do with all these hate groups? He, like Mike Minogue, would need a bigger pot. Alas, Angela Berlandi ain't walking through that door, but Spencer Pratt's crew, or someone like them, could be, if only Mike Minogue would start paying attention. Hey, Minogue, throw another log on the fire.
From business, ABC sues the FCC over license review. Further escalating its battle with the Trump administration, ABC on Tuesday took the rare step of suing the Federal Communication Commission on First Amendment grounds, saying the agency's demand for early review of its broadcast licenses posed an existential threat. In the lawsuit, ABC, its parent company Disney, and the eight ABC-owned stations whose licenses are affected asked a federal court to stop the early renewal proceedings. The FCC, under Chairman Brendan Carr, an ally of President Donald Trump, had ordered the early review in April, itself a rare move. Of all eight licenses owned by ABC, years before they are set to expire. The FCC cited the network's diversity and inclusion practices as a reason, but the development came shortly after a joke by ABC's late-night host, Jimmy Kimmel, an outspoken Trump critic, had infuriated the president, who has called for Kimmel's firing. Again and again, the administration has attacked ABC's speech, the stories its journalists report, and the viewpoints its network program airs. The network alleged in its lawsuit Tuesday, over time, those attacks have escalated into expressed demands that ABC be stripped of its broadcast licenses because of its speech. Facing this existential threat, it added, plaintiffs have no choice but to seek redress from the judicial branch of the administration's blatant retaliation for their First Amendment speech. It said ABC had no alternative means to eliminate these ongoing and immediate threats other than total capitulation to the administration's demand. It asked the court to immediately enjoin defendants from taking or threatening to take any action against plaintiffs in relation to the early license renewal applications. The network has also been fighting Carr's efforts to make the morning talk show, The View, whose hosts and guests are often critical of Trump, subject to equal time rules. That's a question ABC says the agency itself decided in the network's favor more than two decades ago. ABC argues The View is a bona fide news program, meaning it's exempt from equal time rules, which require granting equal airtime to competing candidates for office. The ABC lawsuit Tuesday also spoke of broad ramifications that go well beyond one network. The consequences of the administration's campaign against free speech reach well beyond ABC, it said. If the administration gets its way, the message to every media company in the country will be unmistakable. Tell only the stories the administration deems favorable or face the coercive machinery of the federal government. In such a world, the press could in no way be described as free. The lawsuit also quoted Carr as saying, when Kimmel made comments that angered the administration, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. These companies can find ways to take action on Kimmel, or there is going to be additional work for the FCC ahead. Carr has made it clear that he is considering revoking ABC's licenses or trying to, in what surely would be a drawn-out legal process. Longtime free speech attorney Floyd Abrams noted that tensions between the press and the commission are not new, but have never been this pronounced. There has been a level of tension between the broadcast media, which seeks full First Amendment protection, and the FCC. Abrams wrote in an email, but not until the Trump administration has the government so directly, so deliberately, and so dangerously sought to limit the freedom of the broadcast press to cover and discuss the news. On Tuesday, an FCC spokesperson says all broadcasters have an obligation to act in the public interest. All broadcasters have a legal obligation to operate in the public interest, even Disney, said a statement from the commission responding to the lawsuit.
This is a short one, but I think it's important that we know what's going on with our teenagers. The ticker says OpenAI launches ChatGPT for teens. OpenAI on Tuesday introduced a version of ChatGPT designed for teenagers, the first generation to grow up with artificial intelligence, who are already using it for schoolwork, questions about daily life, and even companionship. The San Francisco-based company says ChatGPT for teens is tailored for kids aged 13 to 17 with stronger protections, including content restrictions around things like suicide, self-harm, and romantic or sexual chats. It also provides homework and study support designed to help students learn rather than spit out answers in school essays. The idea is to guide teens toward healthy AI use in an age-appropriate environment, the company said. We want to treat teens like teens, which means that they have to make sure that we're showing up with the right developmental stage and we're not either talking down to them or treating them like kids. But we're also making sure that they're not exposed to material that shouldn't be exposed to, Anne O'Leary, vice president of the global policy of AI. The effectiveness of the safeguards remains to be seen, said Brendan Bouffard, associate general counsel of AI and privacy at children's advocacy group Fair Play. Announcements like this can be seen as a step in the right direction, he said. But I also would be cautioned against parents being lured into a false sense of safety based on the announcement. In the U.S., more than 70% of teens are turning to AI chat boxes for companionship and use, and half use AI compensations regularly. Companions regularly. According to the 205 study from Common Sense Media, a group that studies and advocates for being digitally media savvy.
Obituary. John Jackie Bulger dies, 88. Younger brother of South Boston mob boss and former state Senate president. John Jackie Bulger, the brother of slain mobster James Whitey Bulger, died last week in his South Boston home. He was 88. He is survived by his other brother, William Billy Bulger, the one-time head of UMass and past president of the state Senate. He is also survived by his sisters, Carol McCarthy and Sheila McKeon, as well as nieces, nephews, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Calling hours are Wednesday at the O'Brien Funeral Home, 146 Dorchester Street, from 4 to 7 p.m., with a prayer service at 7 p.m. Burial will be private. Jackie has long been tied to his clan and seldom backed away from a reporter calling for comment. The youngest of the Bulger brothers, Jackie, was stripped of his state pension after lying to a grand jury about visiting one of Whitey's cash-stuffed safe deposit bank boxes in Florida. Like Whitey, Jackie ended up in custody of the Bureau of Prisons, but loyalty was a constant in his life, even if he paid for it. The Dorchester Reporter wrote Jackie was the only family member at Whitey's sentencing hearing and that he was there every day during the trial. The Herald was also there the day Whitey was sent away for life without parole and Jackie walked out to face the cameras. Whitey was beaten to death at age 89 on October 30th, 2018, just 12 hours after arriving at the USP Hazleton Prison in West Virginia. Per the Boston Herald, mob hitman Foetus Freddy Gies and other inmates attacked him with a padlock in a sock. Whitey was serving two life sentences plus 5 years for directing or participating in 11 murders during his reign of terror in Boston. Bulger was the nation's most wanted man while on the run for 16 years until being spotted in 2011 in Santa Monica, California. $822,000 in cash hidden in the walls of his apartment where he lived with his lover on the lam. Jackie and Billy sued the Federal Board of Prisons over Whitey's murder, but ultimately lost. Billy still lives in Southie.
Duxbury Horror. Doc testifies about Lindsay hearing voices. Psychologist says accused killer told husband during a phone call about a message to kill. Forensic psychologist Dr. Paul Zazel testified Tuesday about the first time he met Lindsay Clancy at the hospital after she killed her children, then tried to kill herself. She wasn't intubated, but she was connected to medical equipment by tubes and wires, he said. Handcuffs held her to the bed, but couldn't move anything below her waist after a two-story fall from the bedroom window paralyzed her. Zeisel was called by Clancy's attorney, Kevin Reddington, to testify for the defense as Clancy stands trial for the 2023 murder of her children, Cora Dawson and Callum, 8 months. Reddington had to get a court order to allow Zeisel into the hospital on February 4th, 2023, 11 days after the killing. She told me that she remembered what had happened, but it was fuzzy, foggy, the psychiatrist testified. Clancy hadn't been allowed any visitors, and she asked Zeisel about her husband, Patrick Clancy, and whether she could call him. Using Zeisel's phone, which the psychologist told her she had to put on speaker, Clancy left messages telling him that she loved him. 2 days later, during another visit, Zeisel allowed Clancy to borrow his phone to call Patrick again. During that call, Zeisel said he first heard Lindsay Clancy reference the auditory hallucinations of the defense, saying that she participated in the killings. She told Patrick that she loved him very much. She was unable to express a lot of emotion, but she expressed love for him. Zeisel said on the stand that she had said she had had heard a male voice ordering her, telling her that she didn't have any choice, but that she had to kill her children and then kill herself. Reddington asked Zeisel if Zeisel had asked Clancy about the voices or suggested it that in any way before the call. The psychologist said he hadn't. Clancy isn't disputing that she did the killings. Instead, Reddington is arguing that his client has suffered from postpartum psychosis when she strangled the three children in the basement of her Duxbury home on January 14th of 2023. Before Zeisel's testimony on Tuesday, jurors also heard from forensic psychologist Elizabeth La Posada and Susan Clancy, Patrick Clancy's mother. La Posada said that also testified in the Karen Reed trial and told jurors that Clancy must have gone out of her bedroom window head first, falling 13 feet and landing on her head, causing a Jefferson fracture of her first vertical vertebrae and the other injuries on her lower spine and ribs. Plymouth Assistant District Attorney Jennifer Sprague questioned how Clancy could have fallen so far onto a frozen ground without any damage to her skull, which was not fractured in the fall, if she had landed on her head according to the medical records, but La Posada maintained her findings. Sprague also questioned La Posada's affidavit, which said that she had taken 5 to 10 seconds for the Clancy children to become unconscious from strangulation by exercise hands. The prosecutor brought out a 2011 case that La Posada testified on, where a mother was accused of manually strangling her child. Then Laposada had testified that it would have taken 10 to 20 seconds for the child to become unconscious and at least a few more minutes for the sustained pressure to die. The doctors said that because the Clancy children were killed using a ligature, it would have taken less time and there would have been a need for sustained pressure because the band stayed wrapped around the children's necks. Clancy cried during the whole portion of the testimony. The defense also called upon Susan Clancy, called Susan Clancy to the stand. The defendant's former mother-in-law said that Lindsay Clancy was a nurturing mother and that the two had a close relationship. Susan Clancy described how her son's wife's mental health started to decline in the fall of 22, and her own attempt to connect with her help, Susan Clancy was also a labor and delivery nurse who worked at a postpartum clinic in the South Shore Health. On cross-examination, ADA Assistant District Attorney Shannon Buckingham asked Susan Clancy more about the months leading up to the killings. Then she inquired about whether the witness was an active member of the Catholic Church. Susan Clancy said yes. Are you aware that murder is considered a mortal sin? Buckingham asked. It's not clear if Reddington had time to object before Judge William Sullivan banged his gavel and called the attorneys over to the bench. The question was stricken, from the record, Sullivan said, you're not going to consider it for any reason.
ESPN co-founder Rasmussen dies at 93 from the effects of Parkinson's disease. Land O'Lakes, Florida, Bill Rasmussen, who co-founded TV sports giant ESPN after hatching the idea for the world's first all-sports cable network with his son, died Tuesday. He was 93. ESPN historian Mike Soltis said Rasmussen died at his Florida home from the effects of Parkinson's disease. Rasmussen announced in 2019 that he had been diagnosed with the degenerative disease in 2014. Bill was a remarkable man, a visionary and innovator who conceived the idea of a network entirely devoted to sports. ESPN chairman Jimmy Pitaro said in a statement, quite simply, none of us would be here today if it wasn't for Bill's passion and all the hard work and entrepreneurial spirit he put into building ESPN in the late 1970s. Key aspects of our company culture that still carry on to this day. Rasmussen and his son Scott came up with the idea of a network carrying sports around the clock, and it would revolutionize Americans' TV watching habits. But the Rasmussens didn't stick around long. They were forced out after only a year by ESPN majority owner Getty Oil. Cable operators initially scoffed at Rasmussen's concept. Bill Rasmussen's original idea was a cable channel covering only Connecticut sports. Many cable operators in the state were skeptical, but someone suggested buying satellite time to reach a national audience. ESPN was launched on September 7, 1979. George Grandy welcomed viewers to the first Sports Center broadcast before the network's first live event, a slow-pitch softball game between the Kentucky Bourbons and the Milwaukee Schlitz. In those days, we didn't know if we'd last 4 weeks, 4 years, let alone 40-some, but we knew it was special, Grand said. Bottom line was Bill Rasmussen was the true purveyor of the original American dream, and he gave us all something very special that we still have today. The Rasmussen secured financial backing from Getty Oil and a rights deal with the NCAA and built a studio in Bristol, Connecticut, still under construction when ESPN went on the air. The Getty investment and the deal with the NCAA occurred on the same day. When someone tells you you can't do something, you want to prove them wrong, Bill Rasmussen said. Many, many people told us there wasn't enough sports to do a 24-hour channel. I didn't argue with anybody. I just thought they were wrong, and I was right. When the Rasmussens were forced out of ESPN in 1980, Getty owned 85% of the network. Texaco, which had acquired Getty, sold its interest in ESPN to ABC in 1984. ESPN helped bring a host of sports to cable. In 1980, only months after its debut, ESPN started televising the NFL draft. The network debuted the ESPY Awards in 1993 and launched the X Games competition in 1995. The college football landscape underwent massive changes. Games were spread throughout the week to tailor to TV audiences, and the number of postseason bowls skyrocketed. ESPN has held exclusive broadcast rights to the college football playoff since it began after the 2014 season. In 2024, the network agreed to a new six-year, $7.8 billion contract for the playoff through the 2031-32 season. While CNN was finding its footing on the news side, ESPN jostled with major networks to bring NFL and college sports to cable audiences that had been over the airwaves for decades. ESPN also pioneered funding and broadcasting women's sports, particularly college basketball, volleyball, and the softball World Series. Rasmussen was courted back by ESPN years later. Bill Rasmussen and ESPN were estranged until 1999, when company executives invited him to the 20th anniversary celebration. Since then, he has been embraced and recognized for his vision of creating an all-sports network. He toured the country in 2019 for the 40th anniversary and gave speeches at Walt Disney Company and ESPN events. Bill was our George Washington and a good friend, said veteran anchor Chris Berman, who joined ESPN 3 weeks after the network launched in 1979. He was such a grateful person, and every sports fan can be grateful for Bill. He wasn't a glass half full guy. His glass was always overflowing with optimism. He greeted everyone with a smile, and we could all smile knowing Bill's legacy. ESPN's debut came after Rasmussen was fired from a previous job. Born in Chicago, Rasmussen earned degrees from DePauw University in Indiana and Rutgers University and served in the Air Force. He started an advertising service business, then worked in radio and television as a broadcaster during the 1960s. He was hired in 1974 as public relations director for the World Hockey Association's New England Whalers in Hartford, Connecticut. The team's entire front office was fired in 1978, and Rasmussen soon turned his attention to brainstorming with his son on the creation of sports on cable TV with the help of a $9,000 credit card advance. There was a whole lot of chutzpah and a whole lot of vision, and they're maxed out on their credit cards. It's the American dream, said Bob Lay, one of the network's original anchors.
Athol, the feds charged soccer coach for child porn. A Massachusetts youth soccer coach has been and therapist has been charged with possessing child pornography. He has been kicked out of the Midnight Riders, a fan club for the New England Revolution. The Revs fan club says it took immediate action to address the arrest of Christopher Abramowitz, a 35-year-old Athol man who was a member of the independent supporters group. The Midnight Riders added, deeming the allegations as a serious and end of concern for members of the membership at large, to formally to terminate a person's current membership and revoke the ability of to petition for the opportunity of next year for future seasons. While the fan club statements did not explicitly name Abramowitz, federal authorities confirmed his identity following the arrest last week. He is currently being detained by the U.S. Marshals Service. While everyone in the is innocent until proven guilty, the club stated in a social media post on Monday, "We want to ensure that our riders community remains safe, welcoming, and family-friendly space." So this was determined to be the best course of action given the corrective circumstances, the current circumstances. FBI agents, with the assistance of local law enforcement, executed federal warrants to search Abramowitz's Athol home last Wednesday for evidence of distribution of the possession of child pornography. The investigators found 231 digital files in a hidden folder on Abramowitz's cell phone, with several showing prepubescent children in various stages of nudity, masturbating, and engaging in sex acts, according to the charging documents. Abramowitz allegedly told law enforcement that he has served as a youth soccer referee and as a referee assigner for the North Quabbin United Soccer Club. The Massachusetts U.S. Attorney's Office stated in a release and that he works part-time for CHD Outpatient Behavioral Health Services in Orange, Mass., where he sees both youth and adult patients. Numerous electronic devices, including laptops, hard tops, and various other electronic storage areas, were seized for the forensic review. The North Quabbin United Soccer Club Youth Travel Soccer Organization has removed Abramowitz from the all responsibilities and access, adding that we'll continue to cooperate with law enforcement. We understand how upsetting and concerning this news will be for our families, the club stated in a social media post. The safety will be and well-being of our players are the highest priority, and nothing is more important to us than providing a safe environment for our children who participate in the programs.
Trey Mancini retires after a five-game Angels comeback, ending a cancer survivor's Major League Baseball run. Anaheim, California, Trey Mancini, the American League Comeback Player of the Year in 2021 for his return from colon cancer, who then helped Houston win the 2022 World Series, announced his retirement Tuesday after his latest comeback lasted five games with the Los Angeles Angels. "Thank you, baseball," Mancini wrote on Instagram. Mancini, 34, agreed to a minor league contract with the Angels in February, a deal that included an invitation to Major League spring training. Mancini hit .273 with six homers, 29 runs batted in, and three steals for a Triple-A Salt Lake this year. The right-handed batter had three hits in his first Major League game since 2023, playing first base in a 5-4 loss to the Houston Astros in 10 innings. Mancini's final Major League appearance was June 14th, and he was designated for assignment on June 17th. "I'm blessed to have made a home in the Orioles organization for 10 years, win a World Series in Houston, play for the Cubs in Chicago. I wish I played better for you guys and make it back up to the MLB with the Angels," Mancini wrote, while also thanking the Reds, Marlins, and Diamondbacks as well. Mancini batted .263 with 129 homers and 404 runs batted in the majors. He played parts of six seasons with the Orioles and hit a career-high 29 home runs in 2019. He then missed the 2020 season after surgery to remove a malignant tumor from his colon. He made a successful return to the Orioles in 2021, and he won a World Series ring in 2022 after Baltimore traded him to Houston. Mancini spent part of the 2023 season with the Chicago Cubs. He has since played in the minor league systems of the Reds, Marlins, and Diamondbacks.
The Pats boost position of need with free agent signing under the Patriots. The Patriots are signing veteran offensive lineman Greg Van Roten. ESPN's Jeremy Fowler first reported on Monday. Van Roten, 36, has 105 career starts in 11 seasons, spread out between the Panthers, Jets, Bills, Raiders, and Giants. The 6'4", 295-pound guard has also spent time with the Packers, Seahawks, Jaguars, and the CFL's Toronto Argonauts. He started alongside Patriots starting right tackle Morgan Moses and left guard Elijah Vaughn Tucker in 21-11 with the Jets. Smart players for sure. Very smart player, Vera Tucker. And Tuesday, Vera Tucker said Tuesday about Van Roten. I mean, obviously, since he's been in the league for a long time, he's just one of the those savvy vets. He obviously knows what to do and how to do it at a high level. So bringing a guy like that is important for just to have the depth. In 2012, undrafted free agent out of Penn started 17 games at right guard for the Giants last season. He also started games at center and left guard in his lengthy NFL career. The Patriots went into training camp shallow in the at guard and center at guard and center even before Ben Brown and Andrew Rupich suffered injuries during the Tuesday preseason opener against the Colts. Brown is expected to miss the rest of the preseason, while the Patriots place Rupich on the injured reserve. The Patriots were left with Mekhi Butler, Darian Dalcourt, James Hudson, Joe Machalski, John Darius Morgan, and Jacob Rizzi behind the Vera Tucker center, Jared Wilson, and right guard Mike Owenuwu in practice Monday. Head coach Mike Vrabel teased earlier this summer that the 2026 first-round pick Caleb Lomu would be cross-trained at tackle and guard, but he's only played left and right tackle so far this summer. What happens is, where do you feel that he can make the roster most make most strides with the roster, and you don't want to derail the improvement that he's making and some of those things. Vrabel said Monday that that's why Lomu has stuck at tackle, and so I'm probably much more like you guys and say, hey, that's is not a big a big part of the deal to go from tackle to guard. I've got a lot of coaches that probably think differently than what you guys are maybe and maybe me think, and that's a little bit bigger deal. But I think Caleb's been working hard. He's been trying to improve, but I think at some point he will need to do as well, and that's just trying to be fair to a kid and the prayer that he's been developing and learning the game and in this league, and then some point the time will probably have to take a look in there. Vrabel said he was asked Monday if the team could sign a veteran guard to supplement the group. That's exactly what they did when they bought in Van Roten. Well, I think we have to be able to evaluate the younger group and see what they do here this week in a competitive setting, and then also in a game. And then also always keep our eyes open when it looks like this, when it looks like around the league, Vrabel said. Among the Patriots' reserve guards and centers, Morgan said Ritchie, undrafted free agents Delacorte and Michalski were signed within the last week. Butler is an undrafted free agent last year. Hudson was converted to guard from tackle this summer, all of which underscores the Patriots' need for a trusted veteran at the position. They're really smart, really, really smart players, Wilson said of the Patriots' young interior defenseman. Come to work every day. They have really good attitudes. Everybody has their days, especially when the rookie in this offense, but they are definitely putting their heads down and doing the work. Vera Tucker, Wilson, and Owenowu have a chance to be among the stronger interior offensive lines in the NFL. But Vera Tucker has played just 43 of 85 potential games due to injury-related absences. Wilson struggled as a rookie in 2025, but he was playing out of position at left guard. It's assumed that he'll play better at his natural position at the center, but that's not a foregone conclusion. All in all, the Patriots' offensive line was a weakness last year. If Vera Tucker stays healthy and if Wilson and left tackle Will Campbell improve, then they can have a potential to be much stronger in 2026. But they desperately need more depth, and Van Roten should fill that. Van Roten allowed just 26 pressures, including 3 sacks, as a starter with the Giants last season. He's played under 2 Patriot offensive coaches. In 2023, under Josh McDaniels, when the Patriots offensive coordinator was the head coach of the Raiders, and briefly under Doug Marrone, when the offensive line coach was head coach of the Jaguars in 2017.
Okay, well, I'm on a run of obituaries here. ZZ Top drummer Frank Beard dies, 77. ZZ Top drummer Frank Beard is dead at 77. Today, Elwood and I lost a great friend and collaborator, and the world lost one of the most naturally innovative drummers and a great and true son of Texas. Band founder Billy F. Gibbons announced on Monday. His signature backbeat was key to keeping ZZ on top. The Southern Rock band announced last week that it would continue its Big Ones tour without its longtime percussionist as he battled health issues. The trio, responsible for hits including Sharp Dressed Man and Cheap Sunglasses, lost bass player Dusty Hill in 2021. He was replaced by guitar tech Elwood Francis. Gibbons said ZZ Top would cancel its Tuesday night show in Salt Lake City and Wednesday's gig in Colorado Springs, but would resume the band's The Big One tour at Austin City Limits in Texas this weekend. He said that venue was one of the drummer's favorite places to play. The band is slated to perform there Saturday and Sunday. They have 2 shows booked in upstate New York at the start of September. The band, of which he was part for 6 decades, is going to keep on keeping on, as he had wished, Gibbons posted on ZZ Top's website. ZZ Top was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2004 by Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards. All 3 of the group's original members spoke, including Beard, who kept his acceptance speech short and sweet. All I have to say is that most of my life has been a pleasant surprise, and so is this, he said. Thank you. They performed their 1975 hit Tush and 1973's LaGrange at that ceremony. Beard, who joined the newly formed band in 1969, died Monday surrounded by loved ones in his Texas ranch, according to Rolling Stone. He'd previously been in hospice. The Bend County Medical Examiner's Office confirmed his death. ZZ Top canceled a highly anticipated August 5th performance at the Hollywood Bowl in Southern California due to unforeseen personal matters. They were to have performed with Cheap Trick.
The nurses blast the CEO's $800,000 raise. Pay boost pegged at 9% comes amid contract standoff. Union nurses at Mass General Brigham spoke out against the news of a Mass General Brigham CEO's 9% raise to nearly $9.2 million in compensation in fiscal 2025. As contentious contract negotiations continue for Brigham and Women's Hospital nurses and the MGM home care clinicians, the fact that MGB CEO received an $800,000 pay hike is almost $9.2 million makes it impossible for MGM to credibly argue that they can't settle a fair contract, said Brigham B&A M&A Bargaining Committee Chair Kelly Morgan. This is about choices. MGH is choosing enormous executive compensation while refusing to negotiate with the nurses and clinicians who provide the very patient care that makes MGM successful. The hospital system CEO, Ann Klibanski, received $9,180,000 compensation for October of 24 and September of 25, according to the most recent MGO's IRS form filings, up from $8.4 million the fiscal year before. About 4,000 Brigham and Women's Hospital nurses and 465 MGH home care clinicians went on strike in July after months of stalled negotiations, making history as the longest Massachusetts nursing strike and marking an escalation in the tensions with the hospital. And I think that's about it for today.